In 1999, a Canberra grandmother died in her hallway following a violent robbery. For two decades, her family have been waiting for answers. Now, two men accused of the murder of Irma Palasics are on trial. In the case of the two intruders, we'll take you inside the courtroom as we watch the jury decide if these are the men who killed Irma. Search for The Case Of on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Brendan Cullen calls himself a glorified shepherd. But if you're thinking rolling green hills and a flock of fluffy white sheep, don't, because Brendan manages a sheep station not far from the one where he grew up, outside of Broken Hill. It's country that he loves and knows like the back of his hand. But Brendan also has another moniker that people in the rest of the world know him by, the Desert Swimmer. Because while he was recovering from a cruel bout of depression, Brendan decided that he would try and swim the English Channel. As Brendan's swim coach, Mike the Tractor, told him, swimming the English Channel, it's straightforward. You get in the water at Dover and just keep swimming until you hit something, and that something is France. Brendan's book is called The Desert Swimmer. Hi, Brendan.
G'day, Sarah. Hell of an introduction, mate.
It's all you. Take me to the property where you live now near Broken Hill. What's the country like
there? Yeah, look, Cars Station. Managed the property there with my wife and three adult kids, in fact. And look, the country is beautiful. Open plains, saltbush country, various colours of green when it rains, of course.
How does it smell when it rains?
Well, there's a word called petrichor, and it's just the most wonderful smell. We don't smell it a lot because our average rainfall is about 175 mil a year, but when it comes, it's the best smell ever. You open the windows in the house and just let the breeze come through, and it's gorgeous.
How does the country there at Cars compare to the sheep station, Mount Westwood, where you grew up?
The country changes a lot south of Broken Hill from north of Broken Hill where I came from. Mount Westwood had a lot of gibber flats, Mitchell grass flats, a lot of sand hills north of the property. East of the property had a lot of ironstone hills, a lot of ranges, the part of the Barrier Ranges, or Cocoa Ranges in fact, a lot of gum creeks. So there was quite a different landscape on Mount Westwood.
Tell me about the walks that you'd go on around the place with your grandma when you were a kid.
I've had some wonderful experience with my grandma. She was pretty much a botanist, so she would walk after rain and go and look for different plants. And as a kid, we'd get dropped over there. My brother and myself would get dropped over there. We'd get looked after. And grandma would just take us onto these hills looking for quartz rocks. And she was also a painter. She did a lot of oil painting. Used to sit in the creeks with her while she painted. And while she painted, we'd go running up and down the creeks looking for eggs, nests, whatever, lizards, whatever we could find. You know, they're moments that I cherish.
Your brother Lachlan is 2 years younger. Were you two each other's best mates on the station?
Yeah, absolutely. We were close, although when he was really young, because Lachlan lost his hand when he was about two.
In a farm accident?
Yeah, unfortunately. And, you know, these things happen. And once he had his hand amputated and he had a couple of hooks on the end of it. And I think he spent his time running around trying to, you know, attack me with it. So I think I tried to belt him a few times with it. Mum reckons I tried to kill him, but but we were really close, and we still are. We're best mates, and, you know, we talk all the time, but we tend to bounce off each other all the time.
Living so remotely, Brendan, what happened when the time came for you to start school?
Yeah, so I left Mount Westwood. I was sent to Broken Hill to do my schooling there. So I basically started boarding at the age of seven.
Where did you live when you were in Broken Hill at primary school?
I initially started with my grandparents, so my mum's parents, and I stayed there for a while, and then I moved into a hostel in Broken Hill where a lot of bush kids went. And I went from one hostel to another hostel.
And how often could you go home?
Yeah, well, probably not often enough for my liking. You know, the day I left was the day that I wanted to go back, you know. And when you're young, you just want to be back with your parents. And, you know, unfortunately, some of those memories are pretty tough, but I remember Mum and Dad coming back into town and you know, they'd pick us up on the weekends or take us back home. But, you know, travelling in and out of Broken Hill back then, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, is not like it is today. But it was all pretty much all dirt and, you know, old petrol motor cars and whatnot. So, yeah, I didn't like it.
Then when it came time to go to high school, it was off to the big smoke of Adelaide. What happened the first day you had to catch a bus by yourself?
Oh, that was bloody horrible, that was. I was actually chauffeured to school and chauffeured back. And then when it was time for me to catch the bus by myself, I remember leaving the school and I had to do an interconnecting bus in the middle of Adelaide. I think I was 12. And when I got off the bus and went to catch the interconnecting bus, all I could see was the number on the back of the bus disappearing down King William Street. And I thought, well, that's it, I'm dead. And so I completely lost it. And this lady come up to me. She said, "It's all right, darling. Yeah, there's another bus coming." But, you know, it was terrifying. And for me it was. And, you know, you had to just try and make it work, and thankfully there were some, you know, awesome people around there. But it did have an effect on me. I mean, it was just tough. I didn't like it.
And you weren't boarding at school. You were living with other families in Adelaide. So basically just joining other families.
Yeah, correct. So I went to Erbre Agricultural High School, and I spent 5 years down there. And, you know, basically I boarded with other families, which, you know, they're not your own. And even though some have every intention, some families have every intention of trying to be like that, it's just never the same. Well, it wasn't for me. I'm not saying everyone doesn't have those experiences, but I certainly felt that it was never the same.
What did living all those years away mean for your relationship with your mum and dad?
Yeah, look, I love my parents to bits, and but unfortunately, because you're away for so long, you know, you just have to find a way yourself a lot. So, you know, they taught me some wonderful ground rules of, you know, being polite to people, you know, using your manners and all that sort of stuff. And I've taken that through with me until today. I've never forgotten those things. But, you know, you're away for a long time, all the time. So some of the values that you attach to your life are values that you are actually trying to find yourself, trying to work out what that means, because you're getting, I don't know, advice from so many different people. You just live in hope that you come out the other side a decent person, yeah.
From a really young age, Brendan, you're away from the safety of home, and some awful things happen to you at the hands of older kids when you were at primary school at Broken Hill and then at the first house you boarded at in Adelaide.
Yep.
Did you tell anyone what had happened, that you'd been sexually abused by these older kids?
Nah, not until I put this book out. It's tough, but, you know, for people to understand my story, they need to understand how I was brought up, you know, and what I endured. Yeah, I mean, you can hear it in my voice now, and it affects me, but it's also a pressure relief valve. You know, I had an issue when I went to my first boarding facility in Broken Hill. I had a really bad experience there, and I had a bloody tough experience when I went down to Adelaide as well. So I just had to deal with it best way I could.
How did going through that and not telling anyone, like having to just hold it alone, how did that shape the kind of teenager, young man you became?
Yeah, I think, look, it was so tough. And I used to ask myself the question, you know, why? You know, why? Is this normal? You know, how do I deal with this? You know, and I mean, who do you tell? who do you talk to? I mean, you can't talk to the ones that are closest to you because you don't want to disclose that stuff. And then, you know, you're moving from one place to the next and then you're dealing with someone else, so you just lock it up. And I think for me, I've locked it up for so bloody long that I just, you know, I see stories about this sort of stuff and I just internally combust. And all I want to do is climb into the television and either, if I'm watching a story, you know, put my arms around these people, or, you know, the opposite is drive in there and bloody knock someone out, you know, the perpetrator. So I have an understanding, and I think that I've become a total empath. And anyone that's doing it tough, mate, yeah, and I say this all the time, is they give me 5%, I'll give them 100% of me.
So an empath for other people, but in terms of the way you spoke to yourself, a kind of inner critic, a really harsh voice against you, it sounds like, appeared at that point.
Yeah, just zero self-esteem. No matter what I was achieving or if I was achieving anything or what I was doing, I just felt that I just wasn't good enough, or I had no understanding of what I was capable of. My schooling waned dramatically and, you know, took a long time to get past that, I must say.
How important a role did footy and footy coaches play then in those years away from home?
Yeah, everything. You know, I'm coachable. It's as simple as that. You know, you tell me to go and do something, I'll go and do it, and I'll do it the best of my ability, and I'll give you more than that 100%. So right up until today. So my footy coaches were awesome. I got a lot out of them. They got a lot out of me. Whatever they wanted me to do, I would do. And they were like father figures to me, particularly one down in Adelaide, the Modra family. They were extraordinary for me. They just looked after me, carted me around, fed me, did an incredible amount of stuff, and I'll be forever thankful for what they've done for me. Yeah.
You made it to the end of high school, Brendan. How happy were you on that last day?
Oh, Sarah, you got no idea how good it was to leave that money. You know, that's, you know, literally 10 years of boarding, and I just wanted to get out of there. And I just remember opening those gates and walking out on the street, and I thought, thank Christ, that's over. Thanks. You know, and I was never nasty, or I was never a bad person to the teachers or anything like that, but I just, you know, I knew I was losing my way a bit, and I was just glad to get out of there because I knew I was going home.
There was a girl you were keen on, Jacinta, and the two of you moved to Adelaide for a bit, and then you began working on properties together, set up as a mustering team. And then it seemed, Brendan, like this thing that you'd been waiting for your whole life happened, and you and Jacinta moved back to your family station. How did that feel to be back there working on the farm?
Yeah, another greatest days of my life moment. I mean, that was extraordinary for Mum and Dad to call up. I remember Mum calling me up and saying, look, you know, your dad needs help. What do you think about moving back here? And you know, I couldn't get there quick enough. So that was a hell of a feeling, you know, that's what I wanted. And it was becoming real, yeah.
What were things like financially for you and Jacinta when you took on that role at the family property?
Yeah, look, we were there for a while. We were there for 7 or 8 years. And financially, you know, as a wage earner, we didn't own the place. My parents owned the place. And we had a young child, and then we had twins, and it was really tough, actually, financially. We weren't keeping up financially, and the burden of having no money was really solid. And I'll never forget, I couldn't afford to buy a pair of boots at one point, and I was talking to Jacinta in the kitchen, I said, I can't even bloody afford to buy a pair of boots, and I just remember that it was bloody ordinary. Yeah.
Were you and your mum and dad talking about what the future was going to look like in terms of ownership of the property or how that would play out?
Not really. We probably weren't that good at having that conversation. I mean, you sort of wish or you hope. Succession is a really tough subject, and it's a common It's common in the rural industry to try and succeed or come into a family, but it's not easy. And for us, we didn't do it that well. We didn't speak about it much at all. And I think, just from memory, it got to a point where it was just time to move on. I just couldn't foresee us becoming owners of the place. I just couldn't see it. And for us, it was more about, well, certainly for myself, it was more about preserving relationships. You know, I love my family to bits, but I have my own little family, and it was time to make a move. And that was, and I did. I pulled the pin and had to go out there and, you know, attack life. So I did.
I mean, as you say, these stories are really common in the bush where, you know, someone mightn't inherit a property, even if they do, till they're in their 50s or 60s themselves, you know.
Absolutely.
For you personally, what kind of state were you in on the day that you leave this station that you'd always dreamt of raising your own family on and working yourself?
Well, it was horrible. You know, there's no other way to explain it. But it probably took me about 3 years to make that decision to walk away, long time, because I knew that was it. I knew that I was never coming back. I knew that once I'd left that I'll never have that opportunity again. And that was the tough part. That's probably why it took me so long. You know, and it's their property. They can do what they want with it. But I didn't realise the effect that it had on me to the point where I got really crook.
After leaving Mount Westwood, you took a job as a station manager at Avenel Station. Mm. What was your workload like there?
It was pretty solid. I must admit, it was bloody solid.
I think that's bush understatement, yeah. Brendan. What do you mean by solid?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, when you're in management and you're bouncing from property to property, you have to get a grasp of, you know, the circumference of the place, you know, where all the watering points are, where, you know, the sheep are watering, just the mechanics of how it all works. So you do a lot of driving, a lot of looking around, and it does take a while to get your head around these places. And, you know, you can go there in a dry time and it's totally different than going there when it's a good season, for example. So it was solid going. There's a fair old workload there.
He had a mice plague while you were there too.
Yeah, that was after a couple of cracking seasons. We had an incredible season in 2011, 2012. Amazing. The country looked unbelievable. But, you know, my kids were lying down in bed and the mice were chewing on their hair and chewing their fingernails. And, you know, we caught 150 mice in our kitchen one night and the mice were eating each other in the traps and it was bloody disgusting. It was terrible. Eating the knobs off your motor car's gear stick, you know.
Those of us who don't live in rural or regional Australia, I mean, stories like that are shocking. And also stories of the drought, you know, you don't know what it's like unless you live through it. What's it like to actually be in those seasons of drought like you were at that station?
Yeah. Look, you never get used to it, Sarah. I think you learn to adapt. There is a build. You know, the more droughts you're in, you think that, oh, yeah, your coping mechanisms are so much better. But in reality, there's a lot of predation, a lot of killing, euthanizing, you know, stock, euthanizing, you know, native animals, just a lot of stuff. So if you're doing that for long periods of time in your life, it actually doesn't get easier, it gets harder. Well, certainly for me it does. I hate killing, but God knows how many animals I've had to destroy over the years. You know, for example, you get up in the morning, you have your breakfast, you'll take off and then you might find a roo that's stuck in a fence with a broken leg, and then you have to pull a sheep out of the bog. There's so many different examples, but it's just horrible. And then adding to that is your projected income. When you're in a drought, your livelihood is disappearing. It's going down the drain. And if it doesn't rain and the droughts go for 2 or 3 years, you know, your projected income is not that flash.
As the years went by in these kind of conditions, how did your body start to let you know it wasn't coping with the stress and the strain of it all?
Yeah. I just remember a time we had stock on adjustment and And I collapsed, but pretty much I couldn't get out of bed. Anyway, basically, they found out I had no testosterone left. So they gave me in testosterone injections, and I had to take those inject myself, which was bloody interesting because I got myself in a couple of bad spots, injecting myself in the wrong bits and pieces, big bloody lumps everywhere. And I had an old mate that injected me on a fishing trip, and it was really weird. But, you know, interestingly enough, Sarah, you know, the warning signs were there, but I didn't listen because it was a matter of actually having to battle on and keep doing my job, and I was silly, really.
How would you wind down after a day's work, long day's work?
Heaps of grog, yeah, self-medicating. So, you know, I have this saying, you know, I love alcohol and it loves me, and we have this love-hate relationship. So when I say heaps of grog, I would probably, you know, drink between 3 and 7 or 9 or 10 beers a night. And then when people would come over, I'd add to that. And so probably the first thing that I would ask Jacinta, for example, if she went to town, 150K trip into Broken Hill, I said, oh, can you make sure you get me 2 or 3 cartons of beer? And it made me feel good, you know, it sort of lightened the load. But with that, Sarah, I've always been someone who's ran, you know, love their sport. So no matter what I had that night, I would make sure I get up and go for a run the next morning. So it was just, I was driving myself into the ground before I even started work. It would be safe to say that I was an alcoholic. Absolutely.
What led to you finally asking for help?
Yeah, well, the RFDS put on a clinic run by Jill Rigney. She was like a life skills coach. And it was a game changer for me. We spent 2 days in Broken Hill.
Was it odd for you even to go to something like that?
Well, it was, and it gave me a chance to get off the property. Oh, 2 days off, this would be good. And she brought out like a questionnaire type thing, and all these boxes that I was ticking weren't good. You know, the alarm bells were going off. I thought, I need to do something about this. That was really the catalyst of me reaching out and asking for help. And
what did that look like? Where did you go?
Yeah, I drove into Broken Hill because when you're crook, number one, you don't realise how crook you are. It's really hard to self-diagnose. And then, you know, and there's all these numbers out there, helplines, all the rest of it, but when you're crook, you don't know where to look. And I thought, well, the best place to go to is in the Broken Hill Base Hospital. So I remember walking up the steps into the hospital, going to the front desk, and I said, I just need some help. And anyway, they sat me down, and I had two clinicians have a conversation with me. And they diagnosed me with depression, yeah, on the spot. That was in 2015.
How did you receive that diagnosis? Well, how did that land for you, that word?
I loved it because it opened a new world up for me. It gave me an understanding of how I felt of finally being diagnosed with something, and now I can confidently go out there and say to people, you know, I've been crook, you know, because I had a million things going on in my head. I couldn't, you know, I spent a lot of time looking back, Sarah, and I couldn't get rid of all the stuff that was floating around in my head. And it gave me the opportunity to change my life. And they put me on a series of antidepressants, which I loved. And it just enabled me to help me change the trajectory of where I was going. Mm.
You've got a great phrase in the book for getting better after that diagnosis, regenerating the top paddock. What did that look like in
practice?
Yeah,
well, you know, what did it look like? Well, it's one thing to be given antidepressants, but it's another thing to be able to change the way you think, you know, to be honest with yourself, you know, recalibrate, however you want to look at it. And that meant that these pills aren't going to do everything for me. I need to actually take it upon myself to actually change how I live, operate.
What about your workload? How did that change?
I just remembered, you know what, when I go back, I'm going to cut that workload back 50%. So I did. And for the listeners out there, they'll be thinking, geez, if you cut back your work life 50%, you know, how the hell are you going to be productive? But I was still doing my job. I was still doing it well, but I wasn't adding to my workload. And a lot of that was on me, because I would set tasks in a day or a week, but they were tasks that I couldn't meet, and that became a constant. So, of course, you get really down on yourself. So I just cut back the load, and also a great friend of mine at the time, David Batty, said, mate, if you don't slow down, you won't see your kids grow up, meaning you won't be present. And he was right. So from that point on, I said, righto, that's it. Family first, everything comes second. And I will not compromise from that, from this point on. And it's the best move I ever made.
How did you end up speaking about your depression and recovery publicly around your community?
Yeah, I was invited by Lifeline to do a talk for the How's Your Mate program, which is an incredible initiative. They asked me if I would tell my story, and I stood up there and told my story in front of all these people. And interestingly enough, it opened my eyes up to a new world of people that are hurting, because beyond that conversation, I had a number of people come up to me, people I knew that were going, mate, well done. I've been through the same stuff. And I thought, my God, they're everywhere. And I couldn't believe it. And it gave them a release, and it gave me a release. And that's when I really knew that I could make a difference in other people's lives. That was incredibly powerful for me. And I thought, right, I'm going to help anyone I can possibly help get through whatever they can get through. That's what I'm going to do.
Growing up on a remote sheep station outside of Broken Hill, Brendan, where had you learned to swim as a kid?
Well, I could always swim a bit. In my dams, I could swim. An old bloke called Bob Crow actually taught me in Broken Hill when I was about 5, I think, went to swimming lessons, but that was about as far as it went. Yeah.
So how did your brother Lachlan get you into open water swimming?
Yeah, he invited me to Sydney to watch him do the Bondi to Bronte open water swim. Because, you know, Locke's got one hand, and, you know, to him that probably doesn't mean much anymore. You know, it's just the way he is. But he's an inspirational character. And so I thought, I'm going to go and watch him, catch up with his mates, get away from the property, all the rest of it. And I watched him swim this Bondi to Bronte, and I was running the course. They've got a running path between Bondi and Bronte, and I thought, I have to have a piece of that. And so that's when I started swimming.
What happened at the first open water race you did together, you and Lockie?
Yeah, well, he's a little bastard for this. I'm going to lay it on thick here, because we swam in Byron Bay, and both of us were bloody petrified of sharks. So we started swimming together, and I had this ideal in my head that, you know, when we get out the water together, we'll run up the beach together, and we'll this is just going to be the best. And we're swimming that close to each other. We're hitting each other constantly and laughing at the same time. So we're swimming, laughing, and shit scared of sharks. And as we come out the water, I'm thinking, this is going to be awesome. He took off like a shower of shit. And left me in his track. So I took off after him, blew a calf muscle. I said to that moment, right, it's on, mate. It's on. So, God.
Well, it was on, because then at the Brighton Baths in Melbourne, you met a bloke called Mike the Tractor.
Yeah.
Why was that a turning point?
Oh, absolute turning point. Well, Mike was running a open water English Channel qualifier at the time. I didn't know that, but I went to the Byron Baths and I just saw this brochure on the wall, and I had a 2-hour, a 6-hour and an 8-hour swim. And I thought, I might do the 2-hour. And I'm about 96 kilos now. I was about 87 then. And it's cold water, so it has to be basically under 16 degrees. And I said to Mike, can I come and do this 2 hour? And he said, yep, absolutely, mate. So I turned up. But he said, come here at 5:30, start in the dark. And I went, not doing that. And it's dark in that bloody open water. Anyway, I turned up about 7 o'clock or something like that and jumped in. And I swam my 2 hours. I knew Mike's credentials as an open water swimmer, you know, Australian Hall of Famer, done some incredible swims. And just as I was about to get out of the water, he looked over at me and said, oh, mate, I'll jump in with you. I'm thinking, geez, no, mate, I'm so cold. But I thought, this bloke is so good, I've got to swim with him. And anyway, he got another half an hour out of me. And when I got out, they helped me to the steam room because I was so cold. But that was the start of our relationship. And what I found is I was swimming longer distance. I've just got this habit, you know, of going that extra mile. And I think after a year and a half, he said, you know what, mate, you should have a look at possibly swimming the English Channel. And I just thought to myself at the time, I thought, that's just ridiculous. How can a bloke 600 kilometres from the nearest ocean even contemplate looking at something like that? You know, the time, just the whole stuff. And I remember walking around my kitchen at the time and thinking, you know what? From that diagnosis in 2015, I changed my life. And I thought, well, what's the worst that could happen? Fail? So I rang him up and I said, righto, let's go for it. And he said, mate, you've just opened up a can of worms here. I said, yeah, righto. I didn't actually know what he meant at the time, but I understand now. Yeah.
Well, as you say, Brendan, with this goal, there is that that small issue that you live hundreds of kilometres from the ocean.
Mm.
Where did you start training to swim the English Channel?
Well, I joined up with the Broken Hill Aquatic Swim Club in Broken Hill, the Stingrays. I reckon the oldest person at the swim club was 14 and I'm in my 40s and I'm thinking, this is a bit weird. And he said, get in and swim. So I did, and I swam, 100 metres, and he looked at me. I was looking up at him and he said, mate, you need a lot of work. And that's where it started, really. And because I did run a lot, it was just a nice change. Plus, I knew that if I could swim a bit, I could catch up with my brother and do some open water swimming. And, you know, it's just a different life to what I was living, you know, in the bush.
So as your training got more serious in the lead up to the Channel swim, as well as swimming in that pool, the public pool at Broken Hill, where else would you swim?
So I had a few options. So I had the Menindee Lakes. So Carr's Station borders about 32 kilometres of lake country. So I was swimming in the lakes. I was swimming in a little channel called Kopi Hollow, which is sort of attached to the lakes. It's like a channel that leaves into the major lakes. My dams.
What are conditions like in those, in the dams and the lakes, particularly when there's not been much rain?
Muddy, murky, you can't see any further than, you actually can't see anything in front of you. There's zero visibility. All you've got is sticks, mud, carp. In fact, the Kopi Channel was quite low at the time and I was swimming in that. I was doing a lot of cold water submersion in there, and I remember I opened my gob to take a bit of air in, and a carp went straight in my mouth. And I thought, that, well, that's a weird feeling. And I spat the carp out. I mean, it wasn't a foot long, but it was big enough to go in my gob and spit it out. But then I had to find sort of like a route in the lake, so I knew I wouldn't run into sticks and logs and, you know, submerged trees and things like that. Or I would swim in my dams. If I had a long day, I'd set the ute up at the top of the dam bank with the lights on and swim at night in the dark.
What good idea did your daughter Emma come up with while you were training for the English Channel?
Yeah, so Emma, my oldest daughter, she came up with this incredible idea of raising some money for Lifeline. And at the time, I was thinking, you know, all I want to do is get to France. I want to swim to France. That was my main focus, and it was like that for a while. And Emma just sort of popped up out of the blue and said, why don't we raise some money for Lifeline? I thought, well, that's a bloody good idea, mate. And she was a significant part of this journey. She come down and watched me train down in Melbourne when I did an 8-hour swim, a qualifier down there, and she was working for Lifeline at the time. So that's what we did, and it was incredible, really, and the support out there was unbelievable.
So finally the day came in July 2022 for you to attempt the English Channel. How long did you think it might take? Like, what was the ballpark?
Yeah, well, I had no preconceived ideas of how long it was going to take. I think the average was about 12, 13 hours.
And what did Mike the Tractor rub you with before you set off?
Yeah, Vaseline. Right, mate, fair enough.
Can you not wear a wetsuit?
You can. You can wear whatever you want, but they won't ratify the swim. Yeah.
So to ratify the swim, you've just got to be in swimmers.
Yep. Yep.
And what about the connection you can have with your support crew for it to be an official swim? How close can you be with them?
Well, your support crew is everything. Mike has this saying, no one does it alone, and he's right. You know, basically from your training through to your support crew on the boat, and I can't touch them. So basically once you get there, you need to make sure you have your passport on you. That's important because you're going to another country.
Surely you don't have to swim with your passport.
No, but, I tucked it away in my swim kit in a really safe spot. So when it was time to pull my passport out, I couldn't find it. I was the only one that couldn't find their passport on the boat. I was bloody shitting myself. And then eventually I found it. And, you know, that mongrel rushing feeling that goes through your body and you think, I've let everyone down. I had that moment. But my swim crew were awesome. They were fantastic, but I remember standing there before we started the swim, and I just sat them down and said, right, I don't care what you tell me, I don't care how you deliver it, just get me to the other side, it's not personal. And so I just gave it to them a bit, but I just expected that they get me across there. Yeah.
What was the weather like that day?
Yeah, it was a bit rough actually, especially when we started. Fairly strong breeze. I think for the first 2 or 3 hours, it was pretty rough.
And what kind of pace were you setting?
I was probably swimming at about 70%. I always was mindful of the fact, Mike always said that there'll be a point in your swim where you got to put the hammer down. And I thought, gee, if you're 11 hours into a swim, how the hell do you put the hammer down? I don't even know what that looks like, you know, but I thought, righto. So I made a point of going out at about 70% just so I could maintain some energy, I suppose, for that moment.
And how often did you eat and drink as the swim was underway?
Yeah, for the first hour I just swam without a feed, and then after that every half an hour, yeah.
And how important was that?
It's everything. I mean, no matter how hard you train, the time and the effort you put in, if you're not feeding properly, there's a good chance you're not going to make it.
So were you keeping track in your head how long you'd been swimming and how much further that meant you had to go with each of those half-hour stops?
I tried to for a while. I tried to sort of, because you don't think of much when you're out there. It's just one arm in front of the other. Someone said, oh, what you can do is count from 1 to 100 and then 100 back to 100 back to 1. Well, I started doing that and I thought, this is just out of control. I can't do this. And so all I was doing was waiting for him to say, righto, feed time. And literally the feeds were no longer than about 10 seconds. So they would throw a lanyard out there with a, you know, a drink bottle on it, not have like a goo or, you know, 350 mils of fluid, Coke with sugar in it and honey and a whole bunch of stuff. Like, it was just carbo-loading extreme.
You'd been swimming for hours and then the sun started to go down. Mm. How did it feel out there in the English Channel as it starts to get dark?
Yeah, well, it was a funny feeling, actually, because the sun just does not go down in the UK. And
certain times of the year.
Oh, my God. And I could remember on my right shoulder, I'm thinking, when are you disappearing? And at that time, I had no idea how far away I was or how long I'd been in the water. But I actually took a little peek, and I saw France I thought, my God, I can see a landmass there. And I looked up again and all I could hear was this voice, put your bloody head down and swim. Like, it was a direct command, because the coast doesn't get any like any closer, any faster. I thought, righto, he's ripped one into me, so my head is down. And I hadn't spoken to my crew hardly at all, which was apparently quite unusual, because it was about, I was totally focused. Anyway, as the sun was going down, I had to transition, take my UV goggles off and replace them with clear goggles because of the night. But I actually found it reasonably comfortable swimming in the dark. But I was expecting on the boat this massive floodlight that was going to light up the side of this, you know, boat and all the rest. It was like someone had a dolphin torch hanging over the edge, and I felt like I'd kept disappearing into the dark, you know, like, and it was a really strange feeling.
Then you hit something called the swimmer's graveyard. What does that mean?
Swimmer's graveyard's where you get a certain distance outside of France, and it's where, so your closest point is Cap Grenet, and that's what you're aiming for. And if you hit a really bad tide or rip, it'll take you away from the coast and it'll add hours onto your swim. And just before I hit that, I remember I'm yelling out, right, it's time to go, it's time to go. And so I put the hammer down. That's when I put the hammer down. I did that for about an hour. And I just thought, I can't keep going like this. Otherwise, I'm going to blow up and I'm not going to make it. I just knew within myself that I wouldn't make it at this pace. And anyway, as it turned out, it was actually the rip going through. So I was literally taken away from France. I didn't know any of this because I had no idea what was going on. I'm just sitting on top of the water. But yeah, it took me away.
What did your coach Mike the Tractor put on to give you that extra bit of firepower?
One of the things when you're an open water swimmer and you're looking at the boat is you can, because your head's down and there's nothing else to see, when you're looking at the boat, you notice everything on the boat. And I noticed Mike shuffling around a bit, and Mike's a Carlton Football Club supporter, and I'm an avid Collingwood supporter. I mean, I love the Pies. I'm a Collingwood supporter through and through. Spread into me. Love it. Anyway, and it's always been an ongoing joke. Anyway, he's shuffling around on the boat, and I look up, and here he is getting around with a Carlton Football Club Guernsey on, and He wanted a reaction out of me. Well, he got one. So I, halfway through my stroke, I gave him the bird, and he turned around to the boys and he said, yeah, no, he's going all right still. So I must have had some bloody sense of humour at the time, but yeah.
So how did you realise you'd hit land? What was that moment?
Oh, it was a surreal moment in my life, really. I was always told by Mike, he said, when you hear the last feed, that's basically the last feed before you're getting close to the land. And I remember at the time, I couldn't hear him properly because I had blue tack in my ears, and he kept yelling out that. And I said, you're fucking kidding me. And anyway, he started stripping off. Because you can swim with someone, but you've got to be behind the swimmer. And they shine this light onto the coast in France. And I really couldn't see anything. I was crook. I got crook the last 3 or 4 hours, and I felt like shit. And it was really tough going. And I knew the gaps between my feeds. And I just knew that I kept swimming for half an hour, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to make it here. I need a feed. So I was yelling out to Mike, I need a feed, I need a feed. And he goes, no, mate, swim to the light. So the boat had, they had to pull up, and there was a light on the beach. And I started swimming towards the light, kept going. And all of a sudden, my left hand dragged through the sands of France. I could, honestly, I was swimming in water that was only about 3 foot deep, you know, I was probably swimming in water that was 3 foot deep for 500 metres. I don't know. But my left hand dragged through the sands of France. I thought, my God, I've actually made it. I've made it to France. And he said, mate, stand up and walk out. And I thought I'd be falling all over the place. But I think I just stood up and walked out. And, you know, I can still feel that now when I'm talking about it. And, you know, it wells up inside of me. But I got there, Mike and I embraced. I bawled my eyes out. I remember that. And I think he might have shed a tear or two at the same time. And then I just had it in my head, Mike, I've got to go and get some pebbles for the kids. So I took off out in the flat. Started, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, mind you. I'm on France looking for some pebbles for my kids. Mate, I landed on the sandiest beach in France. There wasn't a bloody pebble anywhere. And Mike just, he started chasing me and he said, mate, you got to get back on the boat, mate. You're losing it. You've completely lost it. So, and the tender car, the craft that they put out, the tender craft, that broke down. So the motor wasn't running on that. So old mate was in his oars, you know. And anyway, we got back in the water, and Mike pushed me up into the craft, and old mate, he rowed me back to Sea Leopard Charter. And
How long had it taken?
17 hours exactly. Yep.
There's a photo of you taken just after you get back on the boat that your mates call the baby bird photo. Why?
Oh, that's Emma. I think it's Emma or Jacinta. She just looks like a baby bird. And yeah, they took all my clothes off, and they put warm clothes on me, and then they put me on the beanbag, and after we embraced on the boat, and I was just so bloody cold. So they covered me over, and I had my beanie on, and they just got my little nose was poking out of the out under the cover, and that was the baby bird shot. But interestingly enough, Sarah, on our way steaming back towards France, my old mate, Bully Evans, who was sat in the back corner of the boat, never took his eyes off me the whole time. The blanket flew off me like half an hour into the trip going back. So he thought he'd tuck it in. Well, he drove his finger right up my back end and he shot me out the front of the boat, woke me up. I could, you know, and I woke up, everyone was laughing, and I passed out again. And it was ridiculous.
How did they know that you'd done it back in Broken Hill?
Well, I got word that it was during the day. I think the AFL, one of the games was being played at the Jubilee Oval, and they announced that I'd made it, that I'd swum to France, swum the channel, and apparently the crowd just went off its head and started beeping the horns in the vehicles. And, you know, Andrew Schmidt, a good friend of mine, he just explained to me what it was like. And yeah, it must have been amazing for them, but it was, you know, it was a good news story at the time. Mm.
That wasn't the end of marathon swimming for you. You went on and swam the channel again the next year in a relay, and then you swam the Catalina Channel.
Correct.
In the States. Mm. And you're planning to swim Manhattan.
Possibly. We'll just wait and see. You know, these things take a bit out of you. So, I mean, there is a thing called the Triple Crown. So Manhattan's the last swim to get the World Triple Crown. That is on the radar, but I can't make a commitment now. But I dare say I will have a crack at it at some point.
How do you connect this swimming, Brendan, with that day you walked through the doors of Broken Hill Hospital and asked for help?
Yeah, well, just giving myself permission to do something different is a good start. What I do know is the open water swimming community is one of the most generous, kind-hearted community that I've ever had anything to do with. And all they want to do is see you to get from point A to point B. It doesn't matter whether you're swimming 100 metres or trying to swim a, you know, in France. It's an incredible community. I never thought it'd exist, to be quite honest. I'm thankful that I lucked myself to fall into that place. But going hand in hand with working in the bush and swimming at the same time, it just gives you an out from your day-to-day life, because I think, you know, working in the bush is, you need an out. You need something else other than that same old conversation. Certainly I do.
And where are you at the moment with that delicate balance of pushing yourself in a good way, like you did for this big channel swim, and pushing yourself too hard like you had been in the years before that?
Yeah, it is a delicate balance, but I've made a few rules for myself, and I carry a mental health toolbox around with me. And if I feel as if I'm wavering from that, it brings me back to the centre. And that's so important because, you know, like, let's say, for example, alcohol, for example, I still have a drink but there'll be times that I know that, nah, my character's changing, nah, this is not good for me, and I'll move away from that again. But there are other things too, and I mentioned earlier that my family is the most important part of the puzzle for me. And being able to be there for my family is everything. And now I just make a point of doing that.
When I think about the struggles and the dangers that you faced as a kid all alone, and how they only got bigger as you grew older by not being able to talk to anyone else about them, how is that different with your own kids? Like, what kind of conversations can you have with them that you weren't able to have at their age?
Well, if there was anything I could give those kids, it was truth-telling. And I think I've been able to do that the best way possible, even though it's in a public space with the book, and it took me a lot of courage to be able to do that. And I remember sending my book to my kids before it was released, and I heard nothing. And I thought, oh, this is not good. But they were so proud of me. I sat down with them in the lounge room and I said to those kids, I said, look, whatever's in that book, I'm really comfortable with, which made them comfortable. And they have been extraordinarily good. And I just wanted to empower those kids and just let them know that if they want to take risks or they want to do something, they can go and do it. It's just a matter of doing it. That's easier said than done, but taking the leap of faith. And if you take the leap of faith to change your life, generally you're going to be able to crack. And it doesn't mean it's going to be successful, but what it does mean is that you're going to scratch that itch constantly. And that's what's important.
Brendan, thank you so much for sharing your story on Conversations, and all best for whatever adventure is next. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Sarah. Thanks very much.
And Brendan Cullen's book, The Desert Swimmer, is written with Paul Mitchell. This conversation was produced by Maggie Morris and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.